wires and he poured 100 watts into the front end of this transmitter that he's selling, which means he blew out the preamp transistor on the front end, and maybe he damaged that first coil. But that first transistor is a $1.50 item. That coil can be rewound. The fuse that he blew is easy to fix. And so as long as the parts are there, and as long as one of those parts isn't a piece of platinum, if you know what I mean, that's a zillion dollars an ounce, then you can make it work if you want to. So I'm a big advocate of used equipment. The piece of equipment you're listening to me on right now, a Kenwood TS-711, 2-meter all-mode. It is a 1985 vintage rig, an oldie but goodie from Kenwood. It's got the world's best frequency synthesizers. Puts out beautiful clean sideband. It only runs 30 watts. It's got a built-in 110-volt power supply. It'll run on 12 volts, 110 volts. It's got a carrying handle, a little bit large. You can buy that thing for around $200 or $300 to get that exact performance. 2-meter sideband, 2-meter all-mode with built-in power supply. Today, brand new, you'd have to spend close to $2,000. Yeah, you're going to get a couple of extra horns and whistles, maybe some digital signal.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Maybe some digital signal processing with the brand new one. But as long as most of the electronics is there, you can make it work. I love this rig so much that I went and bought another one. I got a total of 3 of them in the house. 2 of them on 2 meters and 1 of them on 450. It's an oldie but goodie. For instance, it's got a hell of a good track record. $200 or $300 will get you one in excellent condition. If you're willing to buy one that's not working, you can probably buy it for $50. And so you can see how I just love used equipment. The idea of buying something brand new that's $2,000 and it goes down $500 in available value in the first year because it's now a used piece of equipment, that bothers me. But that's just my particular attitude, and whether or not you want to go that way is your choice. If you happen to be a guy who's well-heeled, where you can write a check and the problem goes away, you don't have to do that. Go out and buy brand new rigs and fill up the shack with some fancy equipment. So I know I got way off to one side on what I'm telling you, Ray, but maybe that helps a little bit. KC2MMY, K2RIW. You got it, Ray.
Okay, Dick, I think you answered most of it. It just depends on what you got there. I guess if you were using 300 ohm to your receiver, at some point you'd have to use a Fallon to get it back to 50. Just you can give me a yes or no on that. I wonder, do I have time for another question, or do you want to move on?
We only have 3 guys that signed in this time, so I'm going to give you the opportunity to ask your second question. But if you had 300 ohm twin lead, and you just took one lead of it and grounded it, and the other lead you rammed it into the semiconductor on the back of the rig, and you used it for receiving, it would work like a charm. You don't want to transmit that way. Receivers are amazingly forgiving. Yes, you're going to give it a little bit better performance if you then put in that Fallon that converts the 300 ohms back down to 50. But you could just ram the 300 ohm twin lead right straight into that SMA, SO239 connector on the back of the rig and do receiving. And you set if your S meter reading S8, it's going to read S7. Good enough. You can do receiving that way because the receiver is so forgiving. So when you do impedance mismatching, the average guy in the beginning loses a hell of a lot of sleep over that. The highest performance per dollar of any transmission line you and I can buy or get our hands on, Ray, is to go to the stockyard for your local cable TV company where they're buying these 70-ohm coax hardline cables on great big reels with a 5,000 feet on a reel. And they run it up and down the utility poles of your block when they're installing that wire, that cable. And when they get down to the bottom of the reel where there's 200 feet left, they're afraid to start another run down the block because they got to use a splice, and the splice is considered unreliable. So they take the 200 feet on the end of that reel and send it back to the stockyard. And you go to that stockyard, you're going to find 7 reels with 150 to 200 feet on it. You get a friendship, you start a friendship with the guy who runs the stockyard. And maybe you've got to give him some little pittance of a fee. But that cable is worth $5 a foot if you bought the equivalent from the Andrew catalog. And you can probably get a
repeater, timeout, cancel.
You can probably talk him into giving you two or three of those reels of 150 feet each, and its stuff is worth close to $5 a foot, and you probably can get all of that for $10. Boy, is that a bargain. And that cable is rugged as all hell. You can bury it under the ground for the next 20 years. But the problem is, it's got 70 ohm impedance. And the average guy says, gee, I got a 50 ohm transmitter, and I got a 50 ohm antenna. That's not going to work. Well, the solution to that is you take a piece of copper, you take a piece of paper tape, and you put it on the cable, and you write 50 ohms on it. Even though it's a 70 ohm cable, you write 50 ohms. And you make sure that that part of the paper tape occasionally faces toward the transmitter and sometimes faces toward the receiver. It'll fool them. You put 70 ohm cable and a 50 ohm transmitter. In the worst case, that's a 1.3 standing wave ratio. That's nothing. And the cable has got much lower loss than anything you can buy by any other means. Just go and use it and it'll work like a charm. If you're doing some real serious moon bounce downrange and you want to get the last tenth of a dB of performance, I can show you a number of articles on how you build this little bit of a impedance matching device that'll match the 50 ohms to the 70 ohms on each end of the cable, if you really want to get persnickety and get the last tenth of a dB. But you are listening to 70 ohm cable that I'm using right now. This 50 ohm Kenwood 711 transmitter is looking into 100 feet of 70 ohm hard line, goes up to the top of the tower, goes to the Yagi. It's a 50 ohm Yagi on the end of that 70 ohm transmission line. And for the last umpteen years, that's what you've been listening to, Ray, as you can see. And I didn't even put an impedance matching device on each end. Go ahead with your next question. KC2MMY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thanks for all that. Definitely answered the questions I had with the impedance stuff. The other question was something that pertained to the discussion I was having last week with N2EO. And I guess my end of it is, what's the difference between a radio wave and a light wave? And if we had similar wattages, why can't, because I heard you mention, why can't we bounce the laser, a laser, let's say, off the moon, yet we can bounce a radio wave off the moon and we can modulate either. But why can't I do it with light? And tell me the difference between a light wave and a radio wave other than the visibility. Over.
Glad you asked this question, Ray. Darn good question. You've got a scientific mind. If I took the frequency you're on right now, 144 megs, and I talked you into going to 600 megacycles, assuming we had a handband there at 600 megs, we got one that's nearby at 430, 450, but assume I went to 600 megs. You've got a gut feel for what 600 megs is. A little bit shorter wavelength, the antenna gets a little bit smaller, the transmitter gets a little bit more expensive, the frequency you generate is a little bit higher. Okay. I could step by step go to higher and higher frequency, but there's a reason why I chose 600 megs. Because if I then make a giant leap at 600 megacycles, and I go to a frequency that is 1 million times higher in frequency, you and I would call that yellow-green light. The difference between light and radio and infrared and ultraviolet and X-ray and cosmic ray HF, VHF, UHF, X-band, all of those words are just the exact same electromagnetic wave, but it goes to higher in frequency. When you really talk about the whole bandwidth of the electromagnetic spectrum, we usually use it as a joke and we say, hey, this circuit is really broadband. It works from DC to light. Well, you could transmit a radio wave at 15 kilohertz. You and I, with a good set of ears, you can hear 15 kilohertz, but you apply it to the right kind of an antenna. Coming up. You can definitely transmit 15 kilohertz, 15,000 hertz. You can definitely transmit that. It's a very big antenna if you want to make it full size, but you don't have to. And you slowly go higher and higher in frequency, and you get to the broadcast band around 1 megahertz, and you get to the ham bands around 3.5 megahertz, and you get to the television bands that used to be started around 54 megahertz, and so on. It's the exact same spectrum. Your eye happens to respond to the portion of the electromagnetic spectrum that you call light. And when you go up there to light frequency, degrees. It happens to be, if you write it down as a frequency, it's 10 to the 15 hertz, real high-end frequency. And for a whole bunch of traditional reasons, they don't measure the hertz up there because they haven't got a camera that goes that high. They measure the wavelength instead. In the old days, the hams didn't have a frequency counter, so they called it the 20-meter band. They measured the wavelength and the 10-meter band and the 80-meter band because you could set up your lecture wire. You could look for the standing wave on your open wire transmission line. You measure the difference between the successive peaks on that transmission line. The 80-meter band would have two peaks that fall 40 meters apart. Half wavelength apart is where you would get the two peaks on your standing wave indicator along your open wire line, when you slid this neon bulb across your open wire line, so to speak. So in the early days, before we could count frequency, we measured wavelength. In the case of light frequencies, they're still measuring wavelength. The middle of the optical band by which you're looking at the stuff in your room right now is 450 nanometers of wavelength. And your eye responds to that. And if you had a real good set of eyes like a snake has got, you could look at the infrared and you'd see the heat coming out of the animal. And you know that that animal's in front of you. He's alive. You open up your jaws and you grab him and you've got a meal, if you know what I mean. So,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It just so happens that the majority of the light that gets through our atmosphere happens to be between 400 and 700 nanometers. And the human eye just happens to have maximum performance in that frequency range. By an evolutionary process, if you happen to be a secular person, or by his hand, if you happen to be a spiritual person, you are designed for this planet. This atmosphere passes that frequency region very well between the sun and the earth, and your eyes happen to peak in that particular frequency region. So it's all the exact same spectrum. You go a little bit lower than infrared, and we call it the upper microwave bands when you do radio astronomy and so on. The antenna you use changes, the technology for generating the signal changes, the technology for detecting the signal changes. And there's great big overlaps in this, but it's all the exact same spectrum. So low frequency, medium frequency, high frequency, radio, X-band, radar, infrared, far infrared, near infrared, optical, ultraviolet, near ultraviolet, far ultraviolet, soft X-ray, hard X-ray, cosmic ray, it's the exact same spectrum, just changing the frequency. Once you know that, you'll be amazed. Let me drop it. You know that at optical frequencies, a lens that's in front of your eye that focuses the light a little bit better into your particular eye because you're nearsighted or farsighted, you know what that lens looks like, or that magnifying glass that you use for looking at the fine print in the newspaper. And I personally have made a lens that works at radio frequencies. As long as you're smart enough, you can go down and at low enough frequencies, and you can make a lens. It just so happens that the parasitic elements in front of a Yagi antenna really are a radio lens. It does the exact same kind of focusing as a magnifying glass. I'll admit it looks very different. But that signal traveling down that boom of that Yagi is going through all of those directors if it's a long Yagi, and it looks at that as a slow wave structure. The signal going down the boom moves a little bit slower than the signal that's a little bit further away from the boom. The light that goes through the middle of your magnifying glass goes slower than the light that goes through the perimeter of your magnifying glass. That's how the focusing takes place. The magnifying glass is a slow wave structure. The directors on your Yagi are a synthesized slow wave structure. It looks different, but the physics is the same. Once you get a feel for this, you suddenly realize it's all the same thing. We're just changing wavelength or changing frequency. Ain't that crazy, your Ray? KC2MMY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, that was great. I think, but the other part of the question was why, because you had said that you can't bounce lasers off the moon. And so that's the other part of the question. Why can't we do it with light if we know that we can do it with radio waves, as in your friend MB does?
Yeah, N2 moon bounce, Barry Forrest. He's done a lot of moon bouncing. That's why he chose those particular call letters. Okay. Talk to Barry and find out what's required. to you and I, looking at that moon rising, we've seen it all of our life, and it's something that's in our backyard. But let's get real. It's a quarter of a million miles away. You make yourself a scale model of moon and earth by using a basketball and a tennis ball, for instance. You'd be amazed how far you got to put them apart to be scale. When a guy sends a radio wave at the moon with ham radio equipment, he's really at the edge of his art. In the old days, before you got real heavy into computer techniques, where the computer is doing most of the work, back in the days when you really had the human hearing with a set of earphones listening to that signal coming back to the moon, what does it take? The highest power transmitter you're allowed to have legally, 1,000 or 1,500 watts of output. The biggest antenna you're likely to build. In the case of 432, it's usually, in the old days, 16 Yagis as a great big phased array of Yagis. That antenna is 20 feet wide, 20 feet high, 13 feet deep. That's 3,500 cubic feet of antenna with 304 elements inside. So you're using a 29 decibel gain antenna that's got 400 square feet of area when you look down the throat of that antenna. You're feeding 1,500 watts into it. That gives you something like a 5-degree beam width signal. That gives you close to a million watts of effective radiated power coming out of that antenna. 1,000 to 1 gain of the antenna, 1,000 watts coming out of the transmitter. You multiply it together, your effective radiated power is a million watts. Let me drop. That really potent signal goes trundling across that quarter of a million miles to the moon. Of the few percent of that signal that hits the moon is only a 0.5 degree wide, and you're using an antenna with 5 degrees of beam width, so only a few percent of the signal hits the moon. Of the signal that hits the moon, 7% of it gets reflected. The rest gets scattered in some other direction of space or absorbed by that regolith on the moon. Of that puny amount of signal that hits the moon and gets reflected, that comes trundling all the way back to a quarter of a million miles, back to your receiving antenna on the Earth, and again you're using 400 square feet, using the exact same antenna to receive that signal, and you've got a state-of-the-art half-decibel noise figure, low-noise preamplifier, 120 dB of gain in that receiver, real good frequency stability everywhere, and you listen to that signal in the noise, and it's a barely perceptible, weak Morse code signal in the noise. You're using the maximum power you can transmit, about the biggest antenna you're likely to squeeze into your backyard, the lowest loss feed line you can get a hold of. You're using the state-of-the-art, most sensitive receiver you can get, and you get a signal that comes back that's not very many decibels above threshold. You're getting the point here? It's hard. You're going to take that little bitty 5-milliwatt laser pointer, or maybe it's the super version you can buy on the internet, which is 100 milliwatts, and you're going to aim it a quarter of a million miles away at the moon, and at the optical frequencies, the moon is probably similar, only a 7% reflector. And now the receiving device that's going to signal coming back is the 5-millimeter diameter of the iris of your eye. You're using a 5-millimeter diameter detector called human eye instead of a 400 square feet receiving antenna in the case of the...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Instead of the 400 square feet receiving antenna you used with the ham radio moon bounce. You can see Ray, there's a huge difference in the hardware that you're using. You'd like to believe that laser is going to do it. Not a chance. Yes, the scientists have sent laser signals to the moon. The astronauts on Apollo, 14 and 15, left this corner cube retro reflector optical device. They left it on the surface of the moon. If you put the most powerful laser you can get a hold of, connect it to a telescope that's a little bit smaller than Mount Palomar, you use that telescope as a transmitting device to send the signal to the moon, you let it bounce off that corner reflector, that whole array of corner reflector cubes that are on that plate that they left on the moon, and then you recollect the reflected signal into either the exact same telescope or another telescope. By the way, round trip to the moon and back is 2.5 seconds. You can transmit 2 seconds of pulse and then go from the transmitting mode to the receiving mode and listen to the echo for 2 seconds, if you know what I mean. So you use that great big telescope to transmit your laser signal to the moon and that great big telescope to receive the laser signal from the moon, yes. Into a good detector, you now can do some precise pulsing techniques, and you will reconfirm the fact that the moon is slowly moving away from us. Something like an inch per year, the moon gets a slightly larger orbit, and by doing precise measurements with that laser ranging technique, it's a laser radar, so to speak, you can do that. But you can see the kind of hardware required because the distance is so great and the powers required are so large because so little of it gets reflected. KC2MMY, K2LIW in the tech deck. Go ahead, Ray.
Okay, thanks for that, Dick. Roger that. I guess I just need a little more power, and I'll be good to go. So, yeah, he answered it. So you can do it. It's just very hard. Okay. So, yeah, that's all for me for now. So, KC2MMY with K2RIW in the TechNet. Thank you.
Come on.
Yeah, Wes recognized. There was a proposal a few years ago where somebody realized that, gee, there's thousands and thousands of these laser pointers. So if at the appointed hour, on the appointed day, we all aim our laser pointer at the moon, will we get enough light that we can see as a reflection? And the answer is no. Each one of your little lasers pointers is putting out milliwatts of power, and you need many kilowatts of power. Because you've got a whole lot of them, you'd like to think the power is going to add up. Well, each individual laser pointer is not coherent. I mean, if I was using two separate transmitters going into two antennas, and I aim both of those antennas at the moon, as long as those two transmitters are phase locked, putting out the exact same frequency and the exact same phase, now the signal coming out of those two antennas adds in a very constructive manner in space, and you get a hell of a lot more power where you want it to go. However, if one of my transmitters is on 432.0 and the other transmitter is on 433.0, for instance, yeah, you are putting more power on the moon when you turn on the second transmitter. But because the second signal is not on the same frequency and same phase as the first, they don't add up anywhere near as desirably as they could. If you could, by some magic, take those thousands of laser pointers and by some magic make sure that every one of them is on the exact same frequency and the exact same phase with the exact same pointing, I think there's a chance you can do it. But as you can see, that would be very difficult. Go ahead, Wes, N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, we're talking about possibly bouncing electromagnetic frequency from the moon in form of very short frequency that would be the laser light. Is it possible? Well, everything you said, you didn't mention the absorption rate and the focusing factor, which is very important. So technically, yes, it is possible to pass bounce laser beam of the moon, but you and anybody else will never see the reflection. The Apollo point laser gets only 1 to 20 photons per pulse, and they send 20 pulses per second at a power level of 5 watts. If I remember correctly, it was a Leopard solid-state picosecond laser that was made by Contenium Lasers, Contenium Lasers, let me drop. And it is only a gigawatt laser in the sense that the IF is fired continuously instead of 20 very short pulses per second, then it would use energy of that range. Additional analogy that I see is to the radar, where the current circuitry of the power amplifier is able to rest. Similar one that I started when I was dealing with the flyback. The much of the power that this thing was able to withstand was 10 times over the rating, just because of the resting factor. So it was an impulse and the rest, no continuity. It's like you're trying to lift up my wife, which is 45 kilograms, and you can do it for an hour, but if you try to hold it 45 kilograms, it would get you tied up to 10 minutes, probably. So technically, yes. But the laser you can get in the stores are not going to have nearly the power of the focus in order to for the reflection to be detectable from the house. And you're going to need to have a way to arm it. The nearest place on the moon, if we have any, would help. But other than that, I believe that without the computer sophisticated technology, it is very hard to be done. Back to you, and to you.
Shows you how my mind works. He told me his wife is 45 kilograms. 45 kilograms is 99 pounds. I live in the imperial world. That's a very nice leg lady. You started off by saying that I did not discuss the focusing requirement. Don't agree with you, Wes. I certainly did. When you're using a telescope as big as Mount Palomar, and I said those words, that is one hell of a focusing device. And you use that focusing device with your laser to do the transmitting to the moon. And on the receiving, you do that Palomar-sized telescope again to do the receiving. That's another huge focusing device, almost the biggest area you and I can get our hands on. And then you get back a weak signal. We have to send quite a few pulses before you do all the integrating and make sure you've got a high enough signal-to-noise ratio to make sure that you're getting a fairly accurate assessment as to what is the real range of the moon today with that particular state of the atmosphere, if you know what I mean. So lasering to the moon, yes, it's doable, but still requires some pretty heavy hardware. It's not something that you and I are likely to do in our backyard for the next few years, so to speak. The nice thing about the laser, let me drop.
Dick, the astronomers use the Astrophysical Research Consortium Apache Point in New Mexico, and it is the laser generated that fires laser to the moon, and the power is about 1 gigawatt, 1 billion watts. So you would need to laser this 5 billion times the power of the normal star bought from the laser pointed in order to do it.
You're just reconfirming what I said, and that is you and I are not likely to do it in our backyard. The technology required in the size of the focusing device or the gigawatts coming out of the laser, this is hardware that you and I can't easily do. So laser ranging of the moon for the backyard experimenter is not so easy. We're not going to be doing that for some time. And this really is the portion of the TechNet West in which we're supposed to be discussing the brief subject of a ham radio nature, and you're stretching it into other subjects here, so you're cheating a little bit. John, go over to the mailbag, KC2WGB, go right ahead, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, everyone on the net. Got a question here. Vertical antennas, similar to ground plane. And comparing a ground plane antenna with something like a station master, and you would like to know, the station master, being it's sort of a collinear, does it always have a lower angle of radiation? That's his question. Back to you, Dick.
And with rare exception, the answer is yes. Everybody knows what a dipole looks like, and the pattern of the dipole is a very classic figure eight pattern. If you see it as a slice through the middle of the pattern, and you see it displayed as a simple graph, if you make it a three-dimensional graph, it's a donut in space, where the majority of the energy is being radiated broadside to the dipole, and very little energy is radiated off the ends. So that is the antenna pattern, the that you get off a dipole. Now, you can take your half-wave dipole and start making it one wave, one and a half waves, two waves, three waves, four waves, 16 waves long. You go to the appropriate chapter of the ARRO antenna book, for instance, and you'll see the much more complicated antenna pattern you get. You start developing a whole lot of very sharp lobes at various points in space when you make it longer. That's the beginning of what I'm going to tell you. Let me drop. An ordinary dipole has a, if it's a horizontal dipole, it's going to, it's assumed that you set it up from north to south, and therefore you want to radiate broadside east to west, and you measure how broad is the beam to the east and to the west, and you're going to find out it's around 90 degrees wide at the half power point. And so that's a very broad beam. That's not a flashlight. I would really like that beam to come out of there like a flashlight. I would like to squirt all of that signal toward London. I'm talking to my buddy in London. I'm asking for higher directivity. The laws of physics are such that you can get any directivity you want if you use enough real estate. You're beginning to do that when you make the dipole a lot of wavelength long instead of a half wavelength long, except that now you've got some extra lobes and funny spaces. If you're smart enough to put that dipole at the focal point of a parabolic dish antenna, so it's like a flashlight, that flashlight has a large number of wavelengths of diameter of that reflector. Very similar to the Goldstone dish, the NASA Deep Space Network Goldstone dish in the Mojave Desert of California, in the middle of the Irwin Army Base. I've been there. That dish is 260 feet in diameter. It's a lot of wavelengths, and it does a beautiful job of focusing. That can give you a 1 degree beam with antenna. Let me drop. So once again, the laws of physics are if you use more real estate to do the radiating, you can make a more narrow beamwidth. You cannot make a more narrow beamwidth out of any arrangement of wire where the physical dimension is only a half wavelength from tip to tip. You can jump up and down. You can use gold plating, silver plating, platinum plating, whatever. You can use any brand of antenna, and there's 5,000 kinds of antennas. Go to any kind of antenna you want. But you make the physical dimension of the antenna end-to-end only half wavelength. You're not going to do very different from 90 degrees of beamwidth. In the case of a station master, the station master is made out of not one dipole, but three or four dipoles that are vertically stacked in a collinear manner. You've used more real estate, and you've fed them just right. It is a vertical phased array antenna. Properly designed, a station master antenna can have not 90 degrees of vertical beamwidth, but it can have something closer to, let me pick a number, 30 degrees, 20 degrees of vertical beamwidth. It has the ability to have higher directivity. If you look at the three-dimensional antenna pattern coming out of the station master, let me drop. You choose the right one, and you can get 15 decibels of gain over a dipole because you've got a number of vertically stacked dipoles. Therefore, the vertical beamwidth is much more narrow. Whatever dimension you've expanded on your antenna and you properly use that real estate, in that plane, you have the ability to develop a more narrow beamwidth. If you can see that three-dimensional pattern coming out of that station master, it is a pancake-shaped pattern aimed at the horizon, and that vertical beamwidth of that pattern is maybe 15 or 20 degrees. So it's very narrow in vertical beamwidth, whereas a vertical dipole would have a vertical beamwidth of 90 degrees. This thing has got something more like 20 degrees of beamwidth, depending on which model you buy. How long it is. So that's where the gain is coming from. That's why you use those as an antenna for a repeater. Because in the case of a repeater, all of your targets you're talking to are on the horizon, somewhere in 0 to 360 degrees in azimuth, and therefore you use this vertical antenna, which has got this pancake pattern that is 360 degrees wide in azimuth, but some small fraction of 90 degrees wide in vertical beamwidth, and therefore by conservation of energy, you're squirting the energy out to the horizon in all directions, and you get a heck of a lot more range out of your repeater when you do that. did the real estate, you've used it correctly, you've not violated the laws of physics, you have the ability to develop that extra directivity. You can't develop directivity without investing in real estate. Location, location, location. KC2WGB, K2RAW, there, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I'm sure Steve has the information he needs now. I guess he's contemplating purchasing a station master. That's why he was asking. Let me drop and we'll go on to the next one.
And by the way, if Steve is a little bit shy of money, I didn't say it's easy, but homebrewing a station master is not out of the question. If you take one apart, the most expensive part there is the fiberglass outer sheath, the radome that's protecting it. The stuff inside is really pieces of semi-rigid coaxial cable. 3, 4, or 5 lengths of coaxial cable, each approximately half wavelength long, all connected end-to-end in a crisscross manner as far as semiconductor and shield. You go to the right chapter of any of the good ham radio books, probably the antenna book of ARRL, you'll see how to homebrew a station master. You can spend $300-$400 to go out and buy one, write a check, and the problem goes away. Or you can invest in $30 worth of material and build your own if you're sufficiently enthusiastic. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Dick, those lengths of the individual, they would be what, quarter wave, alternately connected?
No. Almost all of the majority of those lengths that are interconnected are electronically a half wavelength long. They're all half wavelength long, except for the very top one. The very top one might be a quarter wave into a short circuit. And depending on how you do the impedance matching at the bottom, maybe the bottom one is a quarter wave. But all the real active elements in the middle are all half wavelength long, John, go ahead.
Okay, good information, which he might need if he's going to. He didn't say he was going to try to build one. But, yeah, that sounds like fun. How he would develop a radome for it, well, he could probably sleeve it in a piece of PVC. That might work. Might be able to do that. Well, sounds like a fun project. Let me pick it up. I'll go to the next one.
Yeah, PVC pipe, properly used, is a beautiful radome for a homebrew station master antenna. The capacitance of the PVC pipe will detune it a little bit. But if he's smart enough, he can retune for that effect. Back to you, John.
And I'm sure if he goes on the web, he can get more information if he attempts to build this. I'd like him to come back and let me know how he makes out with that, because that could be a big savings. Coax is cheap. and so is the PVC pipe. It sounds like fun. Okay, let me let her drop again. All right, here's a question from a guy named Joe. He's looking to buy a kicker for his 30-watt rig, and it does 2 meters, also 6, and I think, yeah, and 400. All right. His question is, what is the difference between a linear amplifier and an amplifier? He doesn't seem to understand the difference. Maybe you could help him out.
Yeah, many of these brick amplifiers that we can buy, Mirage, Tokyo High Power, and whatever. In the case of FM service, where the signal coming out of the transmitter is constant in amplitude, and you're just frequency modulating with the signal coming out of the microphone, the audio, any old amplifier at the right power output and the right power input will do the job. And you can take that amplifier that was intended for Class C service, as they say, FM service, which is not very linear, and you then feed a linear signal into it, an AM, ham radio modulated transmitter, or a single sideband. You can feed that signal through it. And during contests, people will tolerate the signal that comes back out, but it's going to be heavily distorted. It's got crossover distortion. It's got flat-topping distortion. That amplifier is a little bit like a Schmitt trigger. You exceed a certain amount of drive power, and the thing jumps up to full power output, so to speak. And the usual way those amplifiers are used, you could say they're being overdriven by 5 dB or so in order to get maximum efficiency. A good Class C amplifier made for FM service could have in the vicinity of 70% RF efficiency. Let me drop. By that I mean you put 150 watts of raw power into it, 12 volts at the 13 amperes or whatever it is, and out comes 100 watts of RF. You're putting 150 watts of DC, and 100 watts of RF comes out of it. That's the good news. Now, there's a whole class of amplifiers that are using a more elaborate biasing technique, more elaborate impedance matching on the input and the output, and when properly done, within the amplitude region for which they are designed, the amplifier is much more linear. You put in 1 milliwatt, and let's assume you get 1 watt of output if it's got 30 dB of gain. You put in 2 milliwatts, and you get 2 watts of output instead of 1 watt of output. That's linear. If every percentage of change of input power gives you the exact same percentage of output power change, then by definition the amplifier has gain and it's linear. That's the good news. The bad news is that a linear amplifier used in the most ideal conditions can never exceed 50% efficiency. And even that 50% efficiency only occurs at a very specific drive power of output. You drive it at a smaller amount of input power, and it runs much lower than 100% efficient, than 50% efficiency. So you pay your money, it takes your choice. You can have either efficiency or linearity, and you can't have linearity with efficiency unless you do some very elaborate feedback techniques. It's a little bit similar to in the old days, asking for an Einstein brain inside of a Raquel Welch body. You don't get that combination. Well, pure linearity and high efficiency in the same amplifier is almost impossible unless, as I said, you use some very elaborate feedback techniques around the amplifier. There are ways of doing
repeater, timeout, cancel.
There are ways of doing it, but it's not easy. Now, in the real world of these purchasable amplifiers, Mirage, Tokyo High Power, and all of the others. There have been a number of articles written saying that if you change the bias network inside, if you do this, this, and this, the amplifier will increase significantly in linearity. And what some guys have got is they add a switch on the front panel where they use it in the normal mode when they're on FM. They flip the switch and they use it in the linear mode when they're sending out a single sideband signal, and they don't want to create as much distortion and splatter. If you use a very nonlinear signal amplifier on a single sideband transmitter during a contest, the guys that are 10 miles away from you, 20 kilohertz up the band, are going to hear the splatter of your signal. You think you're on 144-200, and the guy that's listening at 144-230 is going to hear you, because your signal is splattering because of the nonlinearity. Whenever you do something to a single sideband signal to make it nonlinear, it becomes more broadband, it becomes more ugly to the ears, even when you're tuned exactly to the right frequency. So you'll make yourself popular with your nearby neighbors. By nearby neighbors, I mean people who are geographically nearby, as well as frequency response, frequency tuning nearby. So, there are lots of guys using some pretty ugly sounding transmitters during a VHF contest or an HF contest who sometimes don't learn this. The amount of effort, let me drop it. It does take a considerable amount of effort to have a properly designed microphone, audio equalizing network, a speech processing network and whatever going into a single sideband transmitter. The transmitter itself properly aligned for good linearity, the amplifier output properly aligned for good linearity. If you do all of those things just right, you can make single sideband sound so clean that the person doing listening at the other end, walking into the shack, will not know it's sideband. It is possible. The early days of telephone, the Ma Bell circuits that we listened to for the last 30 years until they started going to the more digital techniques, were single sideband transmitters, believe it or not. So sideband itself is capable of perfect linearity if you give it the right effort. Most of us use heavy speech processing. We drive the living daylights out of the amplifier because we're looking at the watt meter and we think that's all that counts. And we can make some very ugly sounding single sideband. Good linearity of an amplifier is achievable, but it ain't easy. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the SECNAT.
Well, there's a case where I recommend he do a little more research before he spends his dollars and find out exactly what he wants. That can really get involved. All right. Very good. I'm going to do a little more research. Let me pull this up. We'll go on to the next one. Let me let it drop. Okay, I have a question on radar cross-section. Question about the stealth aircraft. This has to do with something he saw on some of these, the B-1 bomber and some of these very stealthy-looking aircraft. He wants to know, he understands that they're not supposed to have any right-angle connections because of reflections, but when he looks at the canopy for the cockpit, he notices it has a very jagged edge. It looks like it has shark teeth. And he wants to know, how does that work? Why doesn't that show up? So I think it's a good question, Dick, and I know you're very familiar with that. Maybe you could help him out. KC2WGB.
I've worked on some of those aircraft. I got a gut feel for where low radar cross-section comes from. I'll give you an example. If I took a flat sheet of metal, 1 square meter, and I aimed it broadside at your radar, and your radar is operating at 1 gigahertz. No, let me make that radar operate at 10 gigahertz. I got a 10 gigahertz radar. I got 1 square meter of sheet metal aimed directly at that radar. From an antenna point of view, you could say that the sheet of metal is receiving some signal as if it was a 1 meter diameter, approximately, parabolic dish. A 1 meter diameter parabolic dish at 10 gigahertz has a gain capability of around 35 decibels. Yes, it's not parabolic, but I could have a 1 square meter dish doing the receiving, and the receiving cable coming out of that feed horn goes over to an adjacent dish, the feed horn, which is again 1 meter in diameter, sending the signal back. So I've got 36 dB, 35 dB of gain on reception, and 35 dB of gain on retransmission. Round trip, you could say I've got nearly 70 decibels of gain. Those two dishes side by side, interconnected in that way, would give you one hell of a big radar echo. I really maximized the area I have available to me and the amount of signal I'm squirting back to that radar. Let me drop. And it's hard to believe that those two dishes side by side, interconnected in that manner, will give you the exact same amount of signal back to the radar as that flat piece of sheet metal that's properly aimed. Because by the laws of conservation of energy, you're gathering 1 square meter's worth of energy and redirecting it back to the radar in phase. So the one flat sheet of metal properly aimed has a huge radar echo. Because of the crazy mathematics that's used for evaluating radar cross-section, everything is compared to a perfectly conducting sphere. If I had a metallic sphere of the right diameter to give me the same amount of echo as that flat sheet of metal, that sphere would probably be something in the vicinity of 100 meters in diameter, would give you the same amount of echo. Yes, the sphere would send the signal out in all directions, but it's got a great big surface area gathering a lot of signal and redirecting it back to all radars in all directions, so to speak. So radar cross-section is rated with reference to the area projected on a sphere of the right diameter. And the projected area of that sphere is how much shadow it casts on the ground at high noon, if you know what I mean. Okay. So sheet metal that's flat, aimed toward the radar, is going to give you a great big echo. The 90-degree corner reflector effect that you get from the wing hitting the fuselage of an airplane at certain orientations, that's going to give you a big echo. So the stealthy airplanes are usually built in a faceted manner. If you look at the F-117 airplane, for instance, let me drop. It's got these very crazy angles all over the place. The net result of that is, in almost all the directions that you care about, the echo from the airplane is extremely small because it's squirting the signal in some other direction as opposed to sending it back to the radar that's looking at it. But there's a couple of very finite angles where it does give you a big echo. But you, the pilot, know the directions where you get a big echo. And because you've done your homework, you know where the radars are located on the ground. So you fly your flight plan accordingly. You make sure that you dwell for very brief periods of time where that radar on the ground is looking at your bad angles. When you plot it as a three-dimensional pattern, the real radar cross-section of that airplane is what they call spike and fuzzball. In other words, you got a whole lot of little bitty echoes in a lot of directions that are so weak that the guy is not going to see them. But in a couple of known directions, you got a great big echo, the spike. So these zigzags all set up in such a way that you know the direction where you're going to get a big echo. And you make sure you avoid that in the way you do the planning of that mission, the way you fly that airplane. So all those little angles are there to make sure you don't have any wide area piece of sheet metal that's favorably oriented. And you want all of your angles, like the trailing edge of the B-2 bomber and these faceted panels on the F-117 and the zigzags around the engine inlets and the engine exhaust and the windows are all done to give you very little echo in the desired directions, and you accept the fact that there's going to be a couple of undesired directions with a great big echo, but you make sure you don't dwell there. There's a lot more going on here as to how you knock down the radar cross-section of an airplane.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If this is the best of all worlds, you'd like to make all of the surface of the airplane out of something like anechoic material. Material very similar to the stuff you put on the walls of an antenna testing chamber, where all the signal hitting those walls gets absorbed and nothing of it bounces off. You'd like to be able to put those kind of materials on the airplane. In the case of the B-2 bomber, they did do a lot of that. A lot of it is very exotic materials on that surface. As such, you're not allowed to walk on that wing of that airplane and scuff it. When you're doing ground maintenance on that airplane, you use all kinds of fancy cranes to come over to where you load in the fuel and load on the payload and whatever. Yeah, don't walk on that wing because it's got some very expensive stuff that you don't want to scuff. So that's part of it, and the shape is the other part of it, and there's even some other techniques. There's a whole bunch of techniques that are capable of being used to knock down the radar cross-section. They all require a lot of hard work and a lot of money and a lot of effort. It ain't easy. But if you do it just right, you can make your airplane give you the echo of about a mosquito. In some directions, it does do that, and I'm not kidding. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Fantastic. But one other question, Dick, when you worked in these chambers, did they take, say, the cockpit, a canopy, and just look at that cross-section by itself, or did they always study the plane as a unit, all assembled?
It's a little bit like saying that the chain is no stronger than the weakest link, John. Do you study the cockpit all by itself? Absolutely. Do you study the wingtip all by itself with the light of the wingtip? Absolutely. Do you study the bomb bay doors open and closed with the crack and the wheel wells with the wheels folded in and folded out? You study all of those things. In order to make an airplane very low in radar cross-section, every single radar must be low in radar cross-section. So whatever is the loudest echoing device on your airplane, that's what's going to dominate. That's the tall pole in the tent, so to speak. You got to knock down every one of those poles to really make an airplane stealthy. You've got to do your homework in every one of those individual areas. In fact, on many airplanes, the echo that you get from the engine inlet, the jet engine inlet, or the echo you get from the cockpit, where the signal goes through the windshield, bounces around on the sheet metal on the inside of the cockpit, and comes reflecting back out. On many aircraft, the echo from the cockpit is one very large component. Over to you, John. KQRIW in the Tech Minute.
Oh, very interesting, Dick. Yeah, I can imagine now what a project that must be. And that, you've answered a question I've often wondered. When I worked for Coastal Geodetic, we did hydrographical surveying, and of course we had to run up our black pennant when we were at sea. And also, this device, which was approximately 2 sheets of metal, about 20 inches square, intersecting at right angles, and it was hung from one of the tips, so it looked like a diamond. So whatever that pattern does, we had an enormous cross-section, radar cross-section. The ships could see us, they get about how far. They could not see the body of the ship as well as they could see that particular thing that we had to run up on the mast. It was enormous. It lit up their whole screen. And I wondered why that was so effective, but you've just answered that.
If there's a version of that, John, where you've got 3 sheets of metal all at right angles to each other. Take 3 round sheets of metal, round out a perimeter, and make them all come together by slotting them just right, so that they're all exactly at right angles to each other. That gives you a kind of a corner reflector in every single direction in three-dimensional space. You hang that from the mast of a ship, and it's going to give you a huge echo. It's going to give you an echo in some cases, at some frequencies, that can give you an echo almost as big as an aircraft carrier broadside. And I'm not kidding. You properly design the right kind of a corner reflector echoing device. It's got a fancy name, and I can't think of it right now. Not IFF, not a beaconer, passive. You could call it a passive beacon, but in fact, they do make a device like that that's put on the pack of materials for a pilot that has to bail out of an airplane. A pilot bails out of an airplane. In some cases, he's got this backpack that's got an inflatable raft, that's got a mast that goes up, and he's got one of these things that he unfolds, and he puts that on the top of the mast. And now when the rescue airplane are flying all over the place, they're going to see this great big echo in the horizon, and they're going to go in that direction and hopefully rescue your downed pilot. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Well, we had so many comments about it being a huge target. Because an aircraft carrier, I don't know, but it really annoyed some of the vessels that had to go by because it did interfere with some of the other signals. But by law, we had to have it up there. But it's interesting how that works. All right, let me drop, and we'll go on to another one. Okay. This is a question about a dish. It's a large dish. Looks like 4 feet. Okay, dish antenna. He wants to know what the effect is at his frequency, whatever it is. If an iris, it's microwave, of course, if an iris was placed in front of it, when opened, the full aperture of the dish is available. As it slowly closes that iris, what is happening to the signal, and what is the attenuating facts? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, parabolic dish antennas are one of my favorites. You take a look at the August 1972 QST front cover. You'll see K2RIW standing on a picnic table at the East Coast VHF Society antenna gain competition of 1971. That was a 12-foot diameter stressed parabolic dish antenna, about 20 pounds of antenna, hand-constructed by me. are being very carefully aimed downrange on this antenna range, because this antenna game competition is who can come up with the most amount of gain that you can still carry, if you know what I mean. So parabolic dishes are arguably the highest gain